Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. It is a Thursday morning. 9:11 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. And just a little housekeeping before we begin the panel this morning. Joe Donahue, if you're a regular listener, had a terrible fall in the autumn, a fall in the fall. And he was out for close to 3 months and in a lot of pain. And he came back at the end of January. He has done every show since then. Through the pandemic, through everything else, he has come in, and the dude needs a day or two off. And so he's going to take today off and a couple of days next week. If he stays on level ground, he'll be back on Wednesday with you, but he really deserves it. The other thing I want to say is thanks to Sarah LaDuke, who has been doing magnificent work producing this program from afar for the most part. She's in today to hold my hand because I forgot how to do it. And she brought me cappuccino. So thank you, Sarah LaDuke. This is the Roundtable Panel, and we have a great panel today. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for your bringing us a nice day for a change here, Ray, when you announced the weather.
I know that
you're responsible for it.
I heard you complain last week that it was my fault that we had a lot of rain.
Yes, I did.
Frankly, I resented it.
I frankly resent your resentment. I think it's just wonderful that you can go on the air and you can tell us you can make the weather.
Yes,
that's unbelievable.
All right. Well, I hope so. Also joining us today, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly is here. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, everyone. It's exciting to be back on the show.
Great to have you guys here. And also Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is here. Hello.
Good morning. It is lovely to hear your voice, Ray.
Really? You know, and I think Rosemary is not... Rosemary is coming. Oh, she's here now. Hello, Rosemary. Oh, I got to click her on. Hey, you see, I got to tell you something. I have not.
You got this, Ray.
I do the Vox Pop show with the guests over the phone during the pandemic, but I have not done the panel since the pandemic started because Joe has done every show. And I hit this button, and then Rosemary or Mayo is there. Hello, Rosemary.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How have you been?
I'm good. I haven't talked to you in so long, Ray. I hate not going into the station every day.
Well, soon enough. I mean, you know, another couple few years, everyone will be back in the station.
3 years, yeah.
Well, I mean, the U.S. now, record number of cases yesterday, 50,700 new coronavirus cases yesterday, surging numbers in California. Governor Newsom there announced ahead of the 4th of July weekend he's closing the bars, theaters, indoor restaurant dining over most of the state. I think it's one step forward, two steps back at times. Alan Shartok.
Yes, that's exactly right. One step forward, two steps back. You know when we used to take the Spanish regions back when the dinosaurs roamed the land?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know how they told you to answer?
They
said, take the question that you got asked.
Right.
And repeat it back.
What you're saying is you're already not listening to the program. Is that the point that we're trying to get here?
No, not at all.
Well, let's find out from Jen Smith. I assume Jen has been listening. Jen, Massachusetts now reported no deaths and things apparently on the upswing in the Northeast. The rest of the country, not so much.
Yeah, and I think our Governor Baker is also saying, you know, that doesn't give you carte blanche to go out and, you know, party buck wild all weekend long. You know, we still have to practice precautions, and there, you know, there's a reason why we got here to, you know, flatten that proverbial curve, but we still have to keep it going. I think the big concern for me as an education reporter is obviously what is happening with schools and what will happen this fall. The University of Washington already reported that within their fraternity system, that where students are still living in the houses, they've had 80 cases. So that's a little bit of foreboding, foreshadowing of what potentially colleges and universities and residential campuses and even, you know, our schools, which have dense hallways, normally might have to deal with.
Rosemary Armeo.
Yes.
Well, you were one early on who I think that you were, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but in listening to the program, you traveled a little bit. You tried to keep your social distance. Are we now headed back to a point where it's masks all around and everybody's staying home?
No, we're not headed to it. We're in it. And I am not going out now. When I have repairmen coming here, I stand well back from them and wear a mask. I don't like to go out. I'm not going into restaurants. I think that we're the whole thing has been mismanaged horribly, and a new spike is coming. And to act otherwise is to be in, you know, Trump's dreamland.
Yeah, but Rosemary, what about the difference between a California Democratic governor and a New York, where Cuomo seems to have been a leader, worried about, you know, the W effect coming back? I mean, we got to give it to some governors for having done it right, don't we?
Yeah, but Newsom didn't get it wrong, Alan. I think his... he made mistakes, as Cuomo did early on. Newsom's was probably an opening too early without regulation. And he has a big and sprawling state, and it got out of hand really fast. So it's understandable, I think. You want to open the economy. You don't want to see us driven into bankruptcy, but not at the cost of public health, and that's what's happened. So instead, I think you're going to see more states clamping back down again.
I agree with you.
Yeah, and so I wanted to also comment on a couple of things. Number one, right now we are looking in the state of New York for a couple of passengers who were on a flight back from Florida to Albany International. They turned out to be infected with COVID. So this is how, you know, the virus is carried back into the state of New York, especially the city. There are deep concerns about that. General travel by car this holiday weekend. I mean, you can't police this kind of travel. People are supposed to quarantine when they enter the state of New York or certain states on the East Coast, but of course not everybody will. Then in terms of education, we, of course, as a faculty member at Siena College, of course, we're trying our very best to prepare for the fall. But, I mean, there's also already the clarity that's emerging from some of the Division III schools that they have canceled fall sports. Now we're trying to see what happens with Division I schools, because, as we know, when athletic teams are traveling and engaging with, you know, they have to travel by bus or to another campus, and they're playing engaging in athletic competitions and then return to their home campus, this is likely going to spread the virus. So we have to be prepared for a return of the intensification of COVID-19 in our area at some point.
Vera,
hard to stop.
Are you prepared at Siena?
I think we're trying our very, very best to be prepared. But of course, we will have to see once students return how well that will work out. A lot of us have concerns that not everyone will abide by the conduct that is expected on campus. We will do our very best to educate and educate students, speak with them about the seriousness of this disease. We have implemented all kinds of measures when it comes to establishing these regulations on campus. Occupancy rates will be reduced in dorm rooms, plexiglass walls to protect staff and faculty. We have the option for students to take any class through the technology we have established online or come to certain classes on campus. We're thinking about larger spaces, maybe tents, maybe, offering courses in the gym, in the library, in larger spaces to reduce the potential for infections. I mean, there are so many things to think about, reflect on, and prepare for. I think it is incredibly difficult, and I know we have had a team of experts on our campus think through all of these potential weaknesses in the plan for months now. And every week they're revisiting those plans to make sure we're still on the right track.
It's definitely an unenviable position to be in because there's just so much unknown. And there's this dual liability, right? So there's this public health liability, i.e. you'll catch a COVID, and nobody wants that. But then there's also the liability on these institutions, on these employers, these companies. Like, one legal question is, can an institution be sued if an employee goes back to work, a student goes back to school, and contracts the disease, which is also just by sheer numbers almost inevitable that will happen.
I think that's a great point. Governor Cuomo continues to talk about trying to get ahead of the curve, and that his point in the early days, we were behind the curve. Now the plan is to get ahead of the curve. As many plans as Siena and all the other colleges make and all the public schools make, and as careful and rigorous as you can be, you can almost be certain that there will be those times when people become infected. And then, Rosemary, what do you do?
Well, okay, so Fauci said if you're mostly on top of things and there's spikes, you can deal with it. But what's happening in the United States right now is that there's widespread, 38 to 45 states are seeing increases. And that's where you're in a situation like Italy was. We're not on top of it, so you can't handle individual spikes. I think it's a very dangerous situation, and have spent days now faulting the government for this. It's also some personal responsibility. Don't go to beaches. Don't go out to restaurants. We got to stay in a little bit longer.
Can I also make a comment on our inability in this country to actually do appropriate and necessary medical tracing? I just want to give an example. I have the daughter of a neighbor of mine. She's a pre-med student. 2 months ago, she did her training as a medical tracer and qualified to do this work over the summer, and she has never been called back or contacted to do any of that work. So it's
that's going to vary.
Jen Smith.
Oh, sorry. That's going to vary very much by state, and it's totally an issue. We don't have, if you listen to the scientists, the epidemiologists are saying we need exactly what we were just mentioned, as well as high quality testing. And that all comes at a human cost. You need people to administer this. You need the supplies to do it, to provide that analysis. Then you need a response. And right now we still don't have reliable treatments. We have well-known prevention tools and methods, but there's still not a vaccine. And then how are you going to make that accessible and affordable to everyone? There are, again, a lot of questions at play. And we already know with this economy in a recession mode right now, that's going to be ever the harder to accomplish.
We saw the job numbers this morning just before we went on, close to 5 million new jobs created or people back to work. We will certainly see some regional, perhaps, activity of virus outbreaks or increases because of that. The economy seems to be perhaps coming back a little bit, Alan.
Well, that's right. The problem, of course, is that you can't fool with a virus and you can't fool it. Two steps forward, three steps back, because obviously the governor of New York is saying, wait a second now. We see what happens when you let people into bars and restaurants, so we're not going to let it happen here.
In New York City.
That's right. He is following the way in which this pandemic is working. And I want to point out And I think Vera may have something to say about this also, is that we're hearing from the experts that as much as 60% of the American people will contract this disease. 60%, 50%, 60%. If that happens, what do you do then?
And I think another challenge.
Go ahead, Vera.
Go ahead, Vera.
Oh, no, I mean, I just wanted to say, and that's not even, you know, sort of people talked about this idea of herd immunity. Well, that percentage is nowhere near what's considered necessary for herd immunity. So, in other words, a lot of people will suffer greatly, getting sick, dying. We don't even know what the long-term consequences are on, you know, many young people seem to think, oh, this is not so bad. I just get sick for a few weeks and then I pop right back to where I was before. Well, no, we see now long-term potential impact on lung capacity and various other side effects that may be emerging. So in other words, we are in a very difficult situation because our death rate will increase dramatically and, again, so unequally because it will affect minority communities, people of color, and areas most dramatically where health care is not widely available. So this is a fundamental question about how we consider each human being in this country. Do they deserve, of course they do in my view, access to the best medical care available in this country, but our healthcare structure does not seem to support such an approach to treat everybody to the best of our ability because we simply lack the health safety net for a vast number of people on the margins. And with unemployment probably increasing again because of what we see in a number of states in terms of infection rates and closure again, so there will be a lot of people on the margins.
Vera, we only
not
have
earning income, losing their apartments, not having access to health care.
Vera, Curious Kelly, we only have 1 minute here before the break. But you had mentioned a few moments ago that you were lamenting the fact that our contact tracing in this country isn't what it should be. And I gather then that you have followed the way they do it in Europe. And what can we learn from that? You have 30 seconds.
So one of the really interesting things is I talk to my family in Germany, of course, at least once a week, and my niece is back at university, my nephew is back in school taking courses, everybody's more or less back at work, and what happens now is that people are continuing to wear masks, but as soon as there is a localized outbreak, public health officials enter the scene, record who was with whom, when, and do these interviews, and they tend to be successful so far in snuffing out larger outbreaks.
All right, we have to take a break here. This is the Roundtable Panel, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's a Thursday morning, 9:33, and Art Blakey today on the program for the bumper music. Thank you, Mike Bowen. You know, it's been a while since I've done this program, and I thought we hit the break at 30:30, and I screwed up. Vera, I cut you off. Our panel today, by the way, is Rosemary Armeo, Vera Acarius-Kelly, Jen Smith, and Alan Shartok. I also forgot, you know, I did the show for 3 months in a row. I should know this, but it's been a while. You can join the fun by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Keep your letters brief if you could. No attachments, no links, no abbreviations. panel@wamc.org. Now, Vera, before we abruptly went to BBC News, you were saying.
Well, I just wanted to make the point that in Germany, the tracing is so effectively established. People actually participate in tracing activities because they understand that once you identify somebody who went to an event and had
you know, an infection, and I think up to 25 people can gather, so they immediately trace the outbreak, identify everyone who was at the event as best to their ability. People then go into quarantine, and that's how it stops.
But isn't that what we're doing here?
Widely. Well, no, because here we don't even keep track of who was at an event. People don't share all the information. This is all not happening as effectively in the United States as it is in other countries. That's why I was saying we don't have necessarily in every state very effective tracing mechanisms. And in Germany, while it is a federal state, this tracing activity is centralized through the public health offices. So here it's depending on how much a governor believes in tracing or supports tracing or spends money on people to be trained or hired for tracing activities. So I suspect Florida doesn't have a very effective tracing system.
But you don't know for sure.
I don't know for sure.
All
but,
right.
You know, the governor of Florida doesn't really believe in, you know.
Alan, do you have any comment? Anybody want to comment before we go to letters?
There is
a way in New York, which has done many things right. You're seeing businesses act. We went up to the Finger Lakes this weekend, and wineries are opening under restrictions. You have to sit far apart. You wear masks up until the time you're actually sipping wine. And you sign a name. Every party goes in, and you sign your name and a telephone number in case there should be a case. You will be traced. So it can be done right. The problem is, again, as Vera has pointed out, we're doing it state by state, so you can't talk about an American response.
Alan.
Well, you know, your point is very well taken about Florida, Vera. You have a governor there who is still one of those Republican types who says, okay, if the president is leading the way, I'm going to follow no matter what, because that's what my political interest is here. And so that is why DeSantis is a disgrace, because we see this incredible spike in Florida. Now, it is interesting, of course, in the summertime that we have these spikes in California and in Florida, you know, two ends of the country with a need by many people, irresponsible need, to go to a beach. That's a big problem.
All right, we got a couple of letters here, and we'll read a few before our break coming up at 9:45 or so. This one's from Jim. Subject heading, wishful thinking. Just yesterday in a Fox Business interview, Donald Trump said again that he thinks the virus is going away soon. And Jim says, shout as loudly as you can. Wishful thinking is not leadership. This is from Chris. Subject heading, virus spike / protests. Is anyone there willing to speak to the fact that these rises happen to be occurring within 2 weeks of the massive protests around the country, when we know that it can take 2 weeks for the virus to present symptoms? Anybody want that?
There's actually an article about that today. Studies showing there has been no increase that's directly traceable to protests. And part of the reason is that they overwhelmingly wore masks, whereas the anti-maskers, you know, who go to the beaches and support Trump and DeSantis, they're the ones who are getting the disease.
Really?
Not protests.
The protesters,
yeah,
overwhelmingly wore masks?
And the overwhelming majority of people protesting are wearing masks. You can see it on TV.
I don't know. I was watching those protests on the television.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Did we get selective images? You know, it's also interesting that just because we see images on TV, certain images might be selected for viewing to send a certain message. But there is evidence that when you are generally outside, of course, with fresh air,
yes,
there's a lower likelihood that you get infected. That's why bars, gyms, and, you know, indoor dining has been more restricted again. Now, interesting is, of course, the fact that in beach communities where people have been significantly less careful and traveled in large family units, and friend groups have gone to the beach and then back home to their own houses or apartments or family units and intermingled. Now, that is what has spread in some of the beach communities, even though you're outside and you're not wearing masks, but because you intermingle with so many different people that you're usually not with, and you go into your community and back out to the beach and then to another community and then to another event,
well,
and that's how that spreads.
Well,
the article I referred to was in the New York Times, and it says epidemiologists had braced for a surge of new cases after the George Floyd protests began, and that have not developed. They think masks are part of the reason, that it's outside is part of the reason, but of course that it would also affect beaches. But it has not happened. So,
Alan,
well, I know that Governor Cuomo, Rosemary, said to me specifically in answering that question about the protesters that he thought that everybody who was a protester ought to be tested.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, the article
definitely being
that while I don't know about this selective viewership, but the New York Times article is saying that overwhelmingly protesters wore masks. It was actually the police holding them back that did not have masks on. And that was the subject of some discussion as well.
So Vera seems to think that CNN is selectively picking out the crowds.
Would that happen? Oh, no.
I don't think
CNN,
it would happen.
I didn't mention that at all. What I want
to say is that
Fox viewers, for example, get only images with protesters without masks. Online media, online social media discussion for people on the, opposed to using masks, they showed all the protesters without masks and critiqued it. So there's clear evidence that certain people, for messaging reasons, selected images.
Wait. I started this whole thing.
Everybody calm down now.
Okay, but let me just say, I don't watch Fox. Okay, I know that that's irresponsible, right, Rosemary? But I don't watch Fox.
Yes, you should watch it so you can critique it better,
right,
Alan.
I know. I watch CNN. And I don't think CNN has ever been accused of what we're saying here. In fact, I watch a lot of people without masks. And we know that this virus can be spread by one person. After all, that's how it happened here in the United States. One person comes, two people get it, four people get it, and then we're off to the races. So when I say that there are an awful lot of people who are doing the protesting who did not have masks on, I think I'm right.
All right.
I just want to say, even this whole discussion right now, again, it goes back to Vera's case about tracing. And if we're not tracing, then we can't actually put facts and say, oh, this is attributed to this, this is attributed to that gathering or this person. We need to do that list. And here's the truth about the workload of these tracers who don't get a lot of training in some cases. But imagine being given a list of 25 or 50 people, and then you have to track down every person that individual had contact with in the past 2 weeks. This is an overburdened system that's underfunded and undersupported.
Okay, is it too much left to state and local governments? In other words, should private enterprise be more involved? For instance, at Turning Stone Casino, you go in, and not only do they check to see if you're within a 120-mile radius, they take your picture for contact tracing. So if any,
right.
So if there is any,
well, it's already happening.
Okay, but
I think there is private entities getting involved. Clearly,
I mean, isn't there certain onus on businesses and any commercial enterprises to make sure that this is happening?
Absolutely.
Like the wineries and the Finger Lakes, it was encouraging to see that they were being careful. It gave me confidence when we were doing that. I had my mother with me, and I worry about her because of age, and that made me feel like, okay, we can go in here, we'll be okay.
With all due respect, how old is your mom? How old is she?
94.
And you're dragging her 94. To a winery in a pandemic. Oh, my God. She is as bold as you are, Rosemary. Good. That's great.
I've locked her up since March.
Pretty
the
bold.
Woman needs a good drink.
So I was in Vermont, however, 2 weeks ago with my husband, and exactly the same thing happened. We had a pizza outside in a parking lot, right? I mean, that was the outside dining was extended into the parking lot of the restaurant. And we recorded our names and our contact cell phone number there. You know, this is fair. This is standard practice for when you engage in any public activity like that. Mm. Secondly, I wanted to say tracers need to work within their own communities. You can't get a tracer from somewhere else who doesn't understand your neighborhood or your area and then make phone calls to cell phones that supposedly are registered and then, you know, somehow track all this information down if you know nothing about your neighborhood. People in the neighborhood don't know you. I mean, this is all very well organized in other countries. You have contract tracers that actually are known by your community.
Well, isn't that the plan, though? I mean, you have people who are applying for those gigs, and they are presumably in the area in which they live.
Well, you know, that's the plan. Have you actually heard that this has been implemented?
Well, I have not had the need of a contact tracer yet, knocking wood.
Have somebody with us who did. Rosemary was actually talking about applying for one of those jobs. Did you ever do that, Rosemary?
I'm a census enumerator, but I did not go to the contact tracing because the paperwork was so onerous.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. All right, we'll pick that up in a minute here. We have many more letters. The email address is panel@wamc.org. It's a little more difficult doing this show with nobody in the room so they can see me scowl. Yeah, we're a little past the break here, and we'll be right back. Blakey of the Jazz Messengers. I think he stole the name the Jazz Messengers from the guy who wrote that one. That was Horace Silver's tune, Moanin', I think. And I think he's ended up stealing the name of the band, but it all worked out. But I digress. It's the Roundtable Panel. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, and aren't you lucky? It's 9:47 on a Thursday morning, and we have a great Roundtable Panel here. Vera Acarius-Kelly, Jen Smith, Rosemary Armeo and Alan Chartok. And once again, the email address is panel@wamc.org. Russ writes, approaching November 3rd deadline, the fact that several large states have waited till the second go-round to take serious measures to control the current pandemic bodes poorly for the economic recovery. Their service jobs won't return now until September at the earliest, and some states, like Florida, have very limited unemployment insurance schemes. This augurs really poor electoral prospects for the powers that be in those states in November. Alan.
What do you think that people like Florida so much, other than the sunshine and all the rest of it? They like it because the taxes are low. And then you say something like, and you hear something like, they have bad, the letter writer tells us, have bad unemployment insurance. That's right, because if you don't pay taxes, what's going to fund a system like that? We have it in New York, and a lot of people from New York go to Florida. I'd love to ask a question of Vera. Vera, and I don't mean this facetiously at all, quite frequently compare what's happening in this country to what's happening in Germany. What is it about the governmental or sociological system in Germany that makes it so much better prepared than we are in the United States?
Well, I think there are a number of things we could look at. First of all, I think the structure and organization, it's more centralized for public health issues. We don't have, we have a mixed health system, of course, which is base level insurance for everyone. We also have, capitalism, where when you pay into a certain system, you get higher level of coverage. But here in the United States,
many people are completely left out of the system, and that is a huge problem. Secondly, I think in this country, we have a profound disconnect between numerous communities and trust in government. I think we have communities who have been neglected, left out, experienced profound racism within the health system against their communities, and they simply don't trust medical advice. There also is a lack of essential education in this country related to data, understanding data, collecting data, systemic evidence, use of evidence. The education system, the basic education system in this country often is very poor, and access to systematic health care has been denied for many decades, maybe hundreds of years, to communities, certain communities in this country, and also lack of trust in the effectiveness of government.
All right. This.
Wow. It's amazing we still function.
Well, I mean, you know, it functions for some of us a lot better than others.
All right, then. This one is from Luke. Alternative teaching methods. Just an idea. I was trying to work out the logistics. It would be ideal to have smaller classes learn outside at any point possible. Obviously, large college lectures would be nearly impossible. However, smaller primary school classes may benefit greatly from outdoor learning, to which I say try that in February. Desks, right. A whiteboard, and a portable mic speaker to help with socially distanced learning may help slow the spread come the fall. Well, I think it's true, but... How are you going to do that?
Yeah, and there's a lot of other challenges at play, you know, when it comes to both, you know, let's just talk about getting people back to work as we're talking about employment rates. If families don't have childcare, it's more likely now that they have an older sibling maybe or a neighborhood teen or people who are home right now that can help with childcare. But, you know, when you're talking about opening school back up the fall, if you have younger kids, like, you are stuck. It's a choice of whether you can go back to work or have someone take care of your child in a lot of cases. And if you have a child or a family or a teacher who's immunocompromised, for example, in Massachusetts, you can't use a nebulizer if you have asthma in a school setting. So what do you do? There's a lot of workaround logistics. You either have to treat a child or person in the morning before school or after school. It can't be done by school nurses. I can't even imagine being a school nurse and thinking about what life is going to be like going back to school this fall.
This one is from Scott. Scott, flattening the curve is the subject heading. My understanding of the goal of flattening the curve is to reduce the number of cases, needs for ICU beds, etc., to a number that is manageable by the healthcare system. The measures we are all taking are aimed at doing that. Some people are taking this idea to mean that we are doing this, it'll keep people safe from the virus, which I don't believe is true. The idea is that most of us won't get the virus is not realistic. Anybody?
And I think
Go ahead,
Jen.
Just briefly, I think again with the virus, there are so many unknowns. And if you look at some of the epidemiology reports that are coming from outside of the U.S., we're already seeing changes and mutations. And we've already added at least three new symptoms, as per the CDC, of what is associated with the virus. And you know, I think it's interesting right now with the defiance of wearing masks and taking other public safety measures when people were like, oh, you know, let's hear it for our essential workers. And they're the ones who are also going to be burdened in our healthcare systems to deal with these things, whether they're low grade symptoms or folks who need ventilators.
Norm writes, students return. If parents are not willing to wear a mask and distance and choose to berate retail clerks when asked to comply with posted rules, how can we expect students to follow the same requests? Although I often do have greater faith in students than I have in parents. Suggestion, fuel stipend to encourage commuters who can live at home and take the edge off of numbers living, studying on campus.
I mean, that's exactly it. We need to reduce the number of students
that are in one space. We need to have make sure we have fresh air circulation. We need to all wear masks. We need to allow students to stay home, especially everyone, actually all employees that that are immunocompromised. There are so many aspects to this, and at some point it is quite likely that colleges will experience outbreaks. Now the question is, can we immediately identify a localized outbreak, or are we late with identifying it and with quarantining those community members? Or let's say if students live in pods and there is a pod-based outbreak, can we identify where, you know, which pod it is and then immediately quarantine? It really is essentially dependent on the strength of the public health system.
You know, Vera, you haven't mentioned the economic part of this, and I'd love to hear what Jen, who is, of course, our education reporter on the Berkshire Eagle, because she has to, you know, she's going around talking to the colleges and universities, that there's an economic reason that they have to reopen, or some of them could go broke. I mean, without naming names, we know in the capital region there are several schools that are on the cusp anyway. So, so you know, on the one hand, we have all of those things you've been talking about, but we also know that this thing is being driven forward by the need to make some money to run, even at a not-for-profit, to run the schools.
You know, absolutely, and I think it's an issue that it's not just exclusive to colleges and universities and schools. I think every industry is suffering and trying to figure out how to make money. You know, we can't, you know, send people back to work if there's no place to work, right? So it is this balance of what you have to do. And I think it's also a push and a challenge for these institutions and these companies to think progressively. You know, how can you make it work? How can you rethink the way you're treating your employees, you're treating the people you serve, to make things more safer, a little bit more equitable, but also keep your engine running, of course.
So one of the things I wanted to mention as a counterexample of something that we would never consider in the United States so far is, as I mentioned, my niece in Germany is back at university. She's a biochem student, and because of COVID, she couldn't do any of her lab courses. This summer, she will not have a university break. Instead, lab courses in small groups are offered, and instead of having, you know, the fear was that students would fall behind and then you would have a huge gap in the labor market and needs would not be filled in a few years. So the government and voters, of course, support this, have decided university students that must take these lab courses or catch up on their work, they're getting monthly stipends, so they don't have to work, but they can study instead. So the work the university students are doing is in essence considered paid labor.
Right,
I think that's a very clever way of approaching a problem like this.
We have to take a quick break here. Vera Akarius-Kelly is here, Jen Smith, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. And I got to say, one of the many reasons I love our listeners is that they know things. So coming out of the last break, I said, oh, there's Monin by Art Blakey, written by Horace Silver. Well, it was not written by Horace Silver. It was written by Bobby Timmons. And I remembered it soon after we got going with the letters. And I was going to say something, but Jim wrote in and said, please correct this error. Bobby Timmons and C. Hendrix wrote Monin, not the great Horace Silver. And the song is 60 years old. I love that our listeners dig the jazz and the hard bop. We'll take a break. We'll hit some news. We'll be back with the panel in a moment. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's a Thursday morning. It's nice out there for the time being. 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We had a very concerned email earlier. Person missed the beginning of the show. Said, well, is Joe okay? Yes. Do not panic. Joe is okay. He is. He's been working his butt off for the last several months. He needs a couple of days off, and he's going to enjoy it. Assuming he avoids stairs or any kind of incline, he'll be back on Wednesday. So just hang in there. Joe is okay.
Not only that, Ray, he's getting a new puppy.
Is that what it's all about?
That's what it's all about. What? It's really so wonderful.
It takes 6 days to get a new puppy? Where's he going?
Well, no, he's got to train the puppy. He's got to, you know.
I thought he needed a vacation. That's a ridiculous excuse.
Well, no. This is a baby. This is a baby.
I saw pictures of the little puppy. Polly is really cute.
Okay. All right. I'll take your word for that. It's the Roundtable panel. Alan Shartok is here. Rosemary Armeo is here. Vera Carius-Kelly is here. Jen Smith is here. I say here. They're on the air, but they're not here, and I'm finding it very vexing that I can't gesticulate and tell them when to shut up. In the meantime, we got this email, Vera, and I'd like you to address this. This one's from Dave. Subject heading, Germany versus the U.S. I'm glad Vera explained the superiority of Germany to the U.S. While American exceptionalism is a bad thing, I can't help wonder where German exceptionalism has gotten the world. All countries have pluses and minuses, but as near as I can tell, our history of immigration is unmatched. I believe there is a reason folks practically die to get here. It's the hope for more opportunities to change our entire society, to pick up a few other practices that others do well, may make what we are less desirable as well. I wish folks would respect the science, but on the whole, I don't know many folks who left the U.S. for any of these other countries. That's from Dave. Vera, you got first.
So, you can't really think about people leaving the U.S. for other countries, but, you know, people always talk about immigration to the United States. Well, of course. But if you look at immigration to Europe broadly and Germany in particular, you have large numbers of Syrian refugees, Iraqi, Kurdish refugees, workers and refugees from Turkey, North Africa, of course. I mean, when you look at migratory patterns, what was an engine in the United States, when you looked at migration and the great contributions that many migrants have brought to the United States, we begin to see that in Germany as well. Germany came very late to this, of course, but I am seeing some of the early benefits that we will see in Germany because of immigration, because, the number of German-born children has gone down. And now we have large numbers of immigrant children, and it will take maybe a generation, and then we will see the great innovative benefit. So when you think about it, what makes the United States special and has attracted lots of immigrants is not necessarily the case today. And I think we should go back to looking at reforming immigration approaches and welcome people once again, of course, not perhaps during the COVID crisis, but shortly thereafter. Immigrants have always made the United States stronger and make all societies stronger, and we should embrace those principles again in the future.
Anybody else want to weigh in?
Well, I would say, you know, I lived overseas for a lot, and I am no apologist for America, and I hate what's happening now. Vera is right. We have said goodbye to a tradition that made us very strong because we welcome people from around the world. The problem is that even I got my I was a little annoyed listening to Vera, who is a European, talking about it. When we heard criticism of Americans in Jordan or in Bosnia, we would say pretty much you lose your right to criticize when you've started two world wars and committed genocide. And that's the problem. You're speaking truth, but you're not listened to in America, Vera, because of the history of your country. And I think pretty soon Americans may be facing the same thing. It's that blind patriotism that makes us stand up to you when you're speaking truth.
Well, I mean, the point is, when you ask me about German history, I will be really honest, and I will be deeply critical, and I can tell you many things about my country's history that I'm angered and about, ashamed. I feel shame about it. But the point is...
And we don't.
Why,
you know, we don't.
Why don't
that would be
we,
a good thing
Why don't
us.
We build on that and make it better? You know, that's
right,
the point.
Right.
Make it, realize
right.
The horrors committed and try to make things better.
Yeah, that's something Germany has done that the U.S. has not. You've come to terms with the history, and you accept criticism and move forward. We have not done that. That's what this whole George Floyd movement is really turning into.
Anybody else?
Yeah, and I just want to say that it's, you know, no country is ideal or perfect in the way that they deal with its differences. I mean, as much as Germany on one hand is... you know, there are people who are welcoming of refugees and people who are not. There are hundreds and hundreds of documented attacks on refugees in Germany. That's a fact. And you know, same here in the U.S. We you know treat our immigrants horribly in many ways that are both systemic and just spontaneous assaults. But you know, this is again why I think. You know, there's a lot of mixed feelings about globalization and global perspective. And some people say, you know, just deal with what's right in front of you. And some people say you have to have a worldview. And I think there's a benefit because of the latter, because you can learn from what other countries are doing. And I think if we took heed, you know, going back to the coronavirus or whether it's dealing with, you know, or shifting demographics, we're not the only ones. And so I think there's more strength and resources and learning lessons from each other. Obviously it has to adapt within your own country's, you know, laws and you're going to have the social struggle aspect as well. But if you can arm yourself with more information, why not?
It's the Roundtable Panel. We have Alan Chartok here today, Rosemary Armeo, Vera Icarius-Kelly, and Jen Smith. And the email address is panel@wamc.org. You know, I slip into Vox Pop mode. I almost gave the phone number there, and that would be a terrible thing to do. Don't even think about calling. This email came in from Sheldon. Sheldon writes, what happened to Mayor Bloomberg? Wasn't he supposed to lead the countrywide tracing effort? Well, what did happen to Mike?
I think we ought to do our homework on that. I suspect he's given the money, and they're using it. I don't think he's pulled back on it, but I do think it's, you know, that his prestige would be important. And I think the letter writer makes a point. Sheldon Rice makes a point, which is, you know, with a Bloomberg at the head of it, we would be a lot better off because people would have more faith in the system. That's all.
All right. This one is from Kevin. Subject heading, Biden talking point. Is there anything Biden can tell the people of the COVID spiking states that would resonate with the purples? Maybe say their governors hurt the state's economy along with Trump because of their denial of mask wearing, or would it backfire?
Well, you know, Biden's whole thing has been to keep quiet.
Yeah, for 90 days.
To keep quiet. And by the way, it's working. He's way out ahead.
Until he has to speak, right? And he presumably will have to speak.
Pardon me, Ray.
Go ahead.
You know, I sense just a little bit of prejudice here.
Really? Because we never hear that out of you. But go ahead.
I think that there is a sense here of you know, the way that it's working, and he is working. Look, you can't argue with success. And the success so far is that Biden, by taking a low profile, and by the way, I think he's a very good talker. I think everybody, you know, gotcha journalism has its place, but it's a little excessive when it comes to Biden. Perhaps trying to prove that they're not only tough on Trump, but also tough on Biden. But, you know, he's way, way out ahead. Now, why would you change that? Or as Lucille Ball said, don't, you know, fool with success.
Anybody else?
Well, I mean, maybe I can quickly say I think he's done a good job with very individualized messaging. He, for example, talked extensively with George Floyd's family members. They were interviewed about their conversation with Biden and his ability to express condolences and to empathize. So these kinds of more
you know, smaller, more community-based moments, I think, have served him well.
This email from Barbara, subject heading, new swine virus. I have a low burn fear that the reports of a new swine virus in China puts us in the same position we were in last January with this current COVID.
Yeah, we've been hearing about this. It's
We're hearing about it. Oh, yeah.
But I mean,
there are reports out there. Sorry, Jen.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's always going to be a new virus. That's the nature of viruses.
You make a point.
This is an early detection now. This is so I wanted to make a point about China. You know, China has been critiqued ferociously for not having been forthcoming on COVID-19, and they deserve a lot of criticism. But here is the turnaround. We are hearing now about this potential for the emergence of the swine virus. Now, years past, we would have never heard anything about a potential virus out of China if there was a way to snuff the information
out.
Now,
wait a minute.
We're hearing about it.
No, but we wouldn't need to know. The experts at the CDC would know, and they share information of all kinds on this, and they have for years. I mean, this isn't the first swine flu that has been out there.
But we publicly wouldn't have heard about it. China would have hidden information from the World Health Organization, definitely from the CDC. I mean, in essence, what we're seeing is a slight pivot in China on, the World Health Organization is sending people to China to look at, with Chinese scientists, to look at this new swine flu situation and figure out the studies and how we need to follow up on this.
Okay.
China is ahead of this one now. It's a pivot in China.
Well, speaking of a pivot in China, China's government and pro-Beijing activists in Hong Kong are condemning what they call foreign meddling in the territory's affairs as countries move to offer Hong Kongers refuge and impose sanctions on China over a new security law. A foreign ministry spokesman urged the U.S. to abide by international law and not sign a sanction bill into law. Meanwhile, dozens of pro-Beijing activists and lawmakers protested outside the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong to demand that the U.S. stop meddling. The condemnation comes a day after thousands took to the streets to protest against the new security law, which outlaws subversive, secessionist, and terrorist activities and carries a maximum punishment of life imprisonment. Rosemary, I've already read that many in Hong Kong are desperately trying to scrub their social media today and yesterday to make sure that they don't run afoul of the new law.
Right. This is a really ominous, not unexpected development. We talked about this earlier in the summer, and the really sad thing to me is that people in Hong Kong cannot look to the United States for support that at one time they might have gotten for us. I think what the mainland Chinese are doing in Hong Kong is exactly what Donald Trump would like to do in this country. He wishes he had those kinds of powers. I think they're tremendously brave, but this is very ominous.
But you know, Rosemary,
yeah.
Trump always needs an enemy. Russia can't be his enemy because Russia and he are, you know, as one.
Tight.
So China looks to me like an obvious candidate. And even here, your point is so well taken that, you know, the Trump's authoritarian tendencies may stop him from doing what needs to be done here.
Right.
But I do think we should
Sorry, Rosemary,
no,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Vera. I was going to say it might be up to Europe to do something about this, especially
The British are paying close attention, of course,
right,
because Hong Kong used to be part of their territory until 1999. It was a colony. But I agree with you, Rosemary, yesterday's events were an indicator of what's to come in Hong Kong. A 15-year-old girl who was holding up a sign, freedom of speech for Hong Kong, was arrested and detained, is in prison now. So we know they're going after children or young people, anybody who utters any opposition. So that is why protesters are deeply concerned. And in fact, we must be in solidarity with Hong Kongers, because this is profoundly upsetting that China is pursuing the complete control of Hong Kong. So
okay, Vera. Vera, while you've got the mic, I'm sorry, Jen. Just one second. I'd just love to know what the nature of the threat that was issued by the Chinese towards the British, which is stop it or, you know, we'll do our own thing with you. Do you have any idea what that was?
I think in general, it just means it's Hong Kong is going to be ruled and managed just like the mainland China, with no ability to express your opinion. Cultural institutions.
No, but they were threatening. No, no, but Vera, they were threatening. They were specifically threatening the Brits with retaliation.
That had to do with their offer to you know help you know Hong Kong citizens find a pathway to citizenship.
Right,
and a lot of Hong Kongers.
You're right, Jen.
Hong Kongers have the right to go to the UK in many ways, or Canada.
No, but Jen, you were right. That is what the fight was about. You're correct. But when the Brits said we may have to find a way to get citizenship here for the Hong Kong people, that's what got the Chinese so annoyed, and they threatened retaliation. What I was asking was, what was the nature of that retaliation going to be?
I suspect economic measures.
I'm sure you're right, but it would be interesting to know what's on the smorgasbord of the possibilities. I'm sorry, Jen, you were going to say?
Oh, well, you know, just going back to what Vera was saying about the, 15-year-old protester who was arrested, what the danger is now is that you're just prone to all these human rights violations. Well, I mean, they're legal, I guess, now under the new law. But this 15-year-old, for example, can now go to prison for life. So imagine your life ending at age 15 because you held up a sign. Let that sit for a minute. And that's what, you know, so many articles, it circumvents speech and everything. You know, it says you can't be critical of the government, which is why people were scrubbing their Facebook pages, because that's such a subjective thing. And then you're subject then to secret trials. You're subject to not having bail. And these enforcers of this law, have impunity. It's very dangerous.
How many years has it been since Great Britain let Hong Kong go?
1999.
Yeah. I wonder if those living in Hong Kong would rather have it the old way.
What they'd rather have is autonomy, I think.
Well, so would Taiwan, right?
Well, Taiwan is being threatened tremendously by China as well, and has lost lots of allies because the Chinese are basically saying that's part of our territory, and if you give special commercial or security protections to China, then you shall also experience economic and political consequences. And Taiwan has lost a lot of support and allies.
I guess my point is that the moment Great Britain stepped away in 1999, whatever you said, it was a foregone conclusion. This day was a foregone conclusion when that happened, right?
Even though they promised otherwise.
Right.
Even though they promised otherwise, but you are so right. I remember saying it to those around me and to myself. It's over. This is it. They can't have
these
two systems.
In essence, that was what everybody's worst fears were, and now they're being implemented. One of the other aspects. So I agree with everything that Jen said. Very important to watch what's happening to human rights and the security courts now. But also, the Chinese are going to begin to scrub history. Now, when you meet young Chinese today, they might not know anything about Tiananmen Square. They might have never heard of the protest, because that's not that the information has been simply scrubbed from all of the, you know, social media sites, and now Hong Kong is beginning to vastly quickly, as fast as they can, digitize information on Tiananmen Square. They had a beautiful museum to record all of the events there, and they're trying to pump it out into the World Wide Web to protect it from Chinese attempts to
eradicate, eliminate, and obfuscate what happened in the past.
All right, we only have a few minutes here before the news break at the bottom of the hour. Let's tackle a couple of emails that have come in. This one is from Saul. Saul said, did anyone hear Rand Paul's position on children and the virus? He basically said they should all go back to school because they're less susceptible and even if sick are more likely to get well. Any truth to that position? And that's from Saul.
No.
He's stated that several times, and Fauci has responded both times to him logically, but apparently without him hearing that. That's a cavalier attitude, that increasing evidence of a Kawasaki syndrome associated with children getting the virus is not fully understood. Mm-hmm. And so to cavalierly send bunches of kids back to school, thousands, millions of kids back to school is just irresponsible. This is not... Rand Paul just seems to think that that's the way to get the economy going, and that's his number one concern.
That's right, that's right. We just have to keep an eye on the whole thing. You know, I find myself in some sympathy for the poor guy who I think he went to jail, who came across and knocked the hell out of him. Out of Rand Paul. We don't like that. We don't think that's right, and I get it. But I certainly understand, based on what we've been seeing from the guy, what the motivations may have been. And by the way, Ray, have we discussed the Lincoln Project, all those Republicans getting together to support Biden?
No, we have not done that yet, and we can do that on the other side of the news if you want.
I wanted to mention it. You get the Bush...
300 did I see?
Well, it's a whole bunch of people from both Bush administrations who are really putting themselves on the line and supporting Biden. And they're going to do ads and the rest of it. And it really is extraordinary.
It was pretty funny. You know, Trump and the GOP said, okay, we've raised $131 million. This is a record. And for about 6 hours, they were pretty happy. And then last night, Biden said, oh, no, yeah, we raised $141 million. So that's the second month in a row that Biden has outraised the incumbent. So it'll be interesting, that's for sure. Oh, my God, he's flabbergasted.
Who, me? No, I am flabbergasted.
Hang on, let me enjoy the moment. That's good.
And you should.
This is from John. John says, New York is past flattening. We are at the reduce and eliminate infection stage. The long-term effects of C-19 aren't known. The short-term can be fatal. Safety allows commerce to take place. And that is from John. Anybody?
Yeah, I mean, we just need to continue to wear masks and identify where outbreaks happen and snuff them out as quickly as we can by putting people in quarantine and treating them appropriately, and then we could actually carefully move forward.
All right,
that is the point.
This is the last email, and then we will have to take a break in about 60 seconds or so. Mary writes, regarding the COVID-19 economic impact on universities, are you aware that universities, for instance, NYU, Fordham, Georgetown, are defending class action lawsuits from students who are suing for tuition reimbursement? I'm interested in your opinions on this. Let's go to Vera first. Vera, about 30 seconds, okay?
Yeah, so quickly, I wanted to say, Siena College, for example, immediately responded once students after our break in March did not return. And they returned, I think Siena returned about $8 million or over $8 million to the students for, you know, services not rendered because students went back home.
All right, we have to take a break. I'm so sorry.
Essential, though. No, that's good.
The bottom of the hour, it's Vera and Ray fighting it out for supremacy here, and I apologize. The clock is king, and so we are going to take a break for the BBC News. Rosemary Armeo, Alan Chartok, Vera Icarius-Kelly, Jen Smith on the panel today, and there's more to come. You can join it by writing us, panel@wamc.org. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's a Thursday morning, 10:33. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue for a couple of days. It's the Roundtable panel. Jen Smith, Vera Icarius-Kelly, Rosemary Armeo. Did I mention Alan Chartok? He's also on the panel today.
I'm here.
Okay, and the email address is panel at wamc.org. We have about 20 minutes or so left here. Police on Wednesday forcibly cleared out Seattle's occupied protest zone after about 2 weeks in a situation that had attracted the complaints of local business owners and the ire of President Trump during a number of Twitter posts, not surprisingly. The order by Mayor Jenny Durkan followed two recent fatal shootings in the area. More than three dozen people were arrested during the early morning ouster, charged with failure to disperse, obstruction, assault, and unlawful weapon possession. I haven't really heard the take of the panel on this zone in Seattle over the last couple of weeks. By the time it pops up, I'm usually doing other stuff in news. Where do we stand as far as the creation of that, Rosemary Armeo, and the subsequent dismantling of that?
Boy, you picked the wrong person on this question. I don't know.
Really?
How's
that's
that?
Impossible. That's impossible. Of course you know.
No, I don't. I have not understood this whole of police free zone since it happened. The police moved out and they took over, and then there were some shootings because we have guns in America, and then the police moved back in. And I don't know what it means. I think it. I don't get it. Sorry.
Alan.
That's well, if quite you get the oversimplification.
No, let's go to
Jen.
Jen,
you go
absolutely.
Ahead.
Oh, you know, I think there's definitely a lot at play, and I think you to really understand what's going on there, you have to really just understand what's happening in Seattle as an area, and why this happened. You can't compare it to quite an Occupy movement, but there are similar undertones of people being frustrated. There's a huge homeless population in that area. There's cases obviously of clashes and racism within the police force, and so this is, you know, an extreme case, but definitely a case of people mobilizing to stand up for their rights. I think the shootings, they're happening on the border, and I think you have to take a closer look at each case. All these shootings are still under investigation. You can't blindly associate them just with
the two teenagers who were killed, you mean?
There are multiple shootings. There are more than just that one. So I just want to be careful when how we're associating that.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, in Albany, we have a problem, Ray, right around our broadcasting area of some very serious crimes. Murders and other things that have happened. There are some people who are really quite, I don't know what you want to say, but opportunistic in that they take advantage of this kind of legitimate protest, and they work their way in, and they do murders, and they do robbery, and they clear televisions out of stores. I think.
Why did the police move out of that area?
In Seattle.
I think the mayor told them to.
Seattle. Everything that Jen and you have said is true. Why did the police move out? The homeless problem was there before. Lawlessness and shooting has been a problem, you know, throughout the whole country. Why did the police move out, which is what set this whole thing up?
I think the bigger question than that is, why wasn't there effective community policing in the first place, which wouldn't have led to the hostility towards that particular precinct, which wouldn't have led to police moving out and this zone being established? Why, now the Seattle police is looking at working on much improved community policing methodologies. Just as we see patterns like this. We saw it in Minneapolis for many, many years, Minneapolis and St. Paul. I went to college there, and I can tell you stories of how violent some of the police officers were. And they're not community policing. And this has to be addressed in many communities, but in particular in communities that have experienced many social challenges, including homelessness, deep marginalization, lack of education, lack of opportunity. I mean, this is a fundamental problem that has to be addressed, and Seattle is just one manifestation
of it. Yeah, that's true all over the country. Why just this one neighborhood in Seattle? It's true all over Seattle. Why just that one neighborhood?
Because it was pressure. I mean, it was definitely pressure. I think right before the East Precinct was vacated, you know, there was this sort of memo that went out from, I think, not the chief, maybe the assistant chief or someone else in the department, but saying, like, you know, you're not going to abandon that area. But then it happened. And I think it was just a case of, you know, being overwhelmed. It wasn't an order. It happened. And I think that is an interesting thing because, you know, what were the police feeling at that point when they left? And then, you know, also I think what we're asking ourselves now is what enabled them, what empowered them to come back and retake over the zone, to retake over the precinct, and what happens next? Those are the questions that we're looking to find answers for and hear reasoning for. And could this happen again?
Well, Jen, what makes you think that they didn't get an order to get out? I remember when they all left en masse, and I remember the station being taken over and all the rest. I mean, what makes you think that they didn't do that? That they weren't told to move out and preserve lives that way and not have violent confrontation with the protesters? I think that the way that it's worked out, somebody's got to give them a little credit. Yeah,
right.
They let
according to some sources, if you read, I've been reading mostly the Seattle Times things on this, but you know, according to the sources, that this is what happened.
He tries to read. Okay. This email came in.
Police,
go ahead, Vera.
The police chief of Seattle has said that no order was given to leave the area, but that the overwhelming number of protesters led to this event.
All right. Anybody want to make a final comment on that before we wrap up here with a stack of letters?
We'll read some letters.
All right, sir. This one is from Doug. Doug says, Biden has been making appearances and giving speeches. Biden has been making appearances and giving speeches. He gave a press conference in Delaware just a day or two ago. He does these during the daytime, and if not for my sitting at home and having a cable news channel on at that precise moment, I wouldn't know that Biden was doing this because only the smallest snippets of the speeches make the evening news. I think unless my information was incorrect, the press conference the other day in which he took questions from reporters, I think that was the first time in 89 days he took questions from reporters. That was my point. And maybe it was not true. I don't know. But I don't think he's taken any questions before a couple of days ago. And that was, you know, close to 3 months.
So again, Ray, the Biden campaign is doing so well. They're light years ahead of Trump right now. In
the tough states, yeah. The swing states.
Not only in the tough states, in all the states, yeah. But especially in the tough states. Why would you go around and change that around?
Oh, it's a winning strategy. It's been done before. I agree. You get out of the way. When there's a dumpster fire, you get out of the way, right?
Right.
All right. This is from Carolita. Carolita's subject heading, Pivot Schmivet. Sorry to be so skeptical, but you can bet if they're talking about a possible new strain of swine flu in China, it's probably here already. Have you not learned anything from the way viruses travel? If it's in China today, it's in New York City tomorrow. Maybe that's what explains all the negative COVID results for people with likely symptoms.
So I would actually disagree with that because the new information on this particular swine flu we know has not been transitioned to humans. So it's a swine on swine virus so far.
Mm-hmm.
So no, it's not here yet.
Swine on swine.
I like it too.
And we're afraid, of course, that it'll be transmitted to humans in a short period of time.
This one's from Jill. Question for Vera. My understanding is that taxes in European countries are higher than the U.S. in order to fund the social services and healthcare services, among others, which are better than the U.S. My question, are people in general, wealthier people in particular, more accepting of paying higher taxes so they can get these better services? My feeling is that the U.S. would not have these problems we have with services if wealthier people paid their fair share and people in general realized what higher taxes could provide them. And that is from Jill.
And I think, Jill, you make a really good point. Our taxes in Europe are higher. We get lots of services for it. People know what services they get for it. And in addition to that, the gap between the wealthy and the middle class, of course, is also growing in Europe, but not as exponentially as in the United States. So the number of super wealthy that we have in most European countries aren't, the difference is not as extreme as in the United States, which makes conversations about paying taxes a little and making contributions to community and larger society a little easier to communicate.
Well, Vera, also, isn't like the minimum wage there pretty significantly higher equivalent than what is in the U.S.?
Yes. Yes, you're right.
And this one's from Sean. Subject heading Hong Kong. Panel, just an editorial comment. Great Britain never really owned that piece of China. They used it at its location to siphon enormous wealth for themselves and Western nations at the expense of the people in that part of the world. Like other European nations of the time and the USA, they practiced the brutal repressive ideas and practices of imperialism. There is no equality or rights in that practice. The European colonists never had the right in the first place to own anything other than superior technology and resources. We should start saying that more clearly.
That's
well,
you said
correct, and that is why Hong Kongers deserve autonomy. They deserve to control themselves.
Okay, but to be clear, the 15-year-old who's in jail shouldn't be in jail, right?
She should not be in jail. She should not get a potential life term, of course, for holding up a sign.
Well, but Vera, should every part of China have that same self-determination? I mean, you say Hong Kong should. Makes sense, but
well, I mean, you look at the history of communities. So you're asking a very big question, but let's focus in. People should not be colonized, and people should not be controlled by authoritarian government. People should have a right to be part of a community and have human rights and be able to express themselves. Now, those ideals should be followed. And if you have those ideals, then you don't have small communities breaking off everywhere. But what you have is deep repression, either because of imperialism and colonialism or because of authoritarian and repressive governments. And that is what causes movements to emerge for autonomy and independence. So look at the Uyghur community in China, right? Sure. We have a million Uyghur Chinese, well, you know, my Muslim minority in China in these concentration camps. I'm sorry, but do we really expect that these people are going to take it? Or do we think there's going to be an independence movement? Well, take your guess.
The interesting thing to me is that Hong Kong has not only benefited the West, it has benefited the communist Chinese. And by they are now in a fight between their principles and their right to assert authority over Hong Kong and their own economic advantage. And it appears to be that the principle is more important to them than the money, which
yep.
is counter to statecraft everywhere in the world. I find that fascinating.
You may find it fascinating, but it certainly was predictable from the first moment, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah, no, I think it was.
The idea of Hong Kong was that mainland China would go along with it because it was to its advantage economically.
Well, what they want is both, Rosemary, obviously. So they want to have their repressive, you know, autocracy, but they at the same time, they want the same advantages that they've had. And I wouldn't want to bet that they won't get them.
And this email came in from Roger. We talked about where's Mike Bloomberg during the contact tracing, and he said Mayor Bloomberg was only going to set up tracking for New York State, and that's true, I believe. This one's from Nicole. Nicole's subject heading, Fox News. FYI, I've been watching Fox News the last couple of days, and it's truly frightening. Not only are they still debunking the necessity for wearing masks by bringing on science experts, quote-unquote, but most of their segments are all rhetoric and fear-mongering about how the radical left is trying to take over the entire American culture, starting with getting rid of the statues. If I watched full-time, I would definitely be afraid of us. And that is from Nicole.
We still have a president of the United States who is now saying, after everybody who works with him and for him, is saying, I believe in masks. I like masks, says this guy, who's just a liar. We know that, and who has killed tens of thousands of people. In my mind, he has. He's responsible for it. He didn't pull the trigger. But, you know, by being the head of the government, he has created this situation where people are dying as a result of his not wearing a mask.
Right. And in addition, Fox News has identified presidential candidate Biden as hard left or the radical left. I nearly fell out of my chair.
Well, he did, you know, and maybe we'll tackle this Monday. We only have 30 seconds, but there was the headline in the news, and I really didn't pull the copy in time. Biden has a housing agenda, something to do with suburbs and single-family zoning, and I didn't pull enough information to get it in the show today, but maybe on Monday we'll talk about that and see how far left he is. Anybody see that in the news?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, that's homework for you guys. No, not even you, Alan. I heard you read.
No, I read all night long. I get up. I you know, use the facilities, and then
I didn't read my briefing report this morning.
You did not read your briefing report this morning?
CIA left it here, but I didn't read it. Sorry.
Oh, I see. All right, last email here, and we only have 30 seconds. Robert writes in, the main difference in the U.S. is our taxes largely go to the military, not to social services.
Very yeah, well, that's a big point to be made. I mean, we're spending enormous amounts of money on the military. Absolutely.
All right.
Jen, was that?
We only have about 10 seconds here. Jen Smith, you may say one word.
Epstein's girlfriend has been arrested by the FBI.
That's more than one word, but that was very good. Thank you very much, Jen Smith from the Berkshire Eagle, Siena College's Vera Icarius Kelly, Rosemary R. Mayo, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. Thank you for listening. This will be posted online in the unlikely event that you'd like to hear it. It'll be there, and we'll see you on Monday.